Side 4. Good Omens. The Nice and Accurate Prophecies of Agnes Nutter, Witch. By Neil Gaiman and Terry Pratchett. Continuing on page 114. They always looked expectantly at Adam. He was the one that had the ideas. "Perhaps we ought to do it ourselves," he said. "Someone ought to be doing something if there's all these witches about. It's like that neighborhood watch scheme."
"Neighborhood witch," said Pepper.
"No," said Adam coldly.
"But we can't be the Spanish Inquisition," said Wensleydale. "We're not Spanish."
"I bet you don't have to be Spanish to be the Spanish Inquisition," said Adam.
"I bet it's like Scottish eggs or American hamburgers. It just has to look Spanish. We've just got to make it look Spanish. Then everyone would know it's the Spanish Inquisition."
There was silence. It was broken by the crackling of one of the empty crisp packets that accumulated wherever Brian was sitting. They looked at him.
"I've got a bullfight poster with my name on it," said Brian slowly.
Lunchtime came and went. The new Spanish Inquisition reconvened. The head inquisitor inspected it critically.
"What are those?" he demanded. "You click them together when you dance," said Wensleydale, a shade defensively. "My aunt brought them back from Spain years ago. They're called maracas, I think. They've got a picture of a Spanish dancer on them. Look!"
"What's she dancing with a bull for?" said Adam.
"That's to show it's Spanish," said Wensleydale.
Adam let it pass. The bullfight poster was everything Brian had promised. Pepper had something rather like a gravy boat made out of raffia.
"It's for putting wine in," she said defiantly. "My mother brought it back from Spain."
"It hasn't got a bull on it," said Adam severely.
"It doesn't have to," Pepper countered, moving just ever so slightly into a fighting stance.
Adam hesitated. His sister Sarah and her boyfriend had also been to Spain. Sarah had returned with a very large purple toy donkey, which, while definitely Spanish, did not come up to what Adam instinctively felt should be the tone of the Spanish Inquisition. The boyfriend, on the other hand, had brought back a very ornate sword, which, despite its tendency to bend when picked up and go blunt when asked to cut paper, proclaimed itself to be made of Toledo steel. Adam had spent an instructive half hour with the encyclopedia and felt that this was just what the Inquisition needed. Subtle hints had not worked, however. In the end, Adam had taken a bunch of onions from the kitchen. They might well have been Spanish, but even Adam had to concede that, as decor for the inquisitorial premises, they lacked that certain something. He was in no position to argue too vehemently about raffia wineholders.
"Very good," he said. "You certain they're Spanish onions?" said Pepper, relaxing.
"Of course," said Adam. "Spanish onions. Everyone knows that."
"They could be French," said Pepper doggedly. "France is famous for onions."
"It doesn't matter," said Adam, who was getting fed up with onions. "France is nearly Spanish, and I don't expect witches know the difference, what with spending all their time flying around at night. It all looks like the Continent to witches. Anyway, if you don't like it, you can jolly well go and start your own Inquisition anyway." For once, Pepper didn't push it. She'd been promised the post of head torturer. No one doubted who was going to be chief inquisitor. Wensleydale and Brian were less enthralled with their roles of inquisitorial guards.
"Well, you don't know any Spanish," said Adam,
whose lunch hour had included 10 minutes with a phrase book Sarah had bought in a haze of romanticism in Alicante.
"That doesn't matter, because actually you have to talk in Latin," said Wensleydale,
who had also been doing some slightly more accurate lunchtime reading. "And Spanish," said Adam firmly. "That's why it's the Spanish Inquisition."
"I don't see why it shouldn't be a British Inquisition," said Brian. "Don't see why we should have fought the Armada and everything just to have their smelly Inquisition."
This had been slightly bothering Adam's patriotic sensibilities as well.
"I reckon," he said, "that we should sort of start Spanish, and then make it the British Inquisition when we've got the hang of it.
And now," he added, "the Inquisitorial Guard will go and fetch the first witch, por favor." The new inhabitant of Jasmine Cottage would have to wait, they decided. What they needed to do was start small and work their way up.
"Art thou a witch, O Lay?" said the chief inquisitor.
"Yes,"
said Pepper's little sister, who was 6 and built like a small golden-haired football.
"You mustn't say yes. You've got to say no," hissed the head torturer, nudging the suspect.
"And then what?"
demanded the suspect.
"And then we torture you to make you say yes," said the head torturer. "I told you, it's good fun, the torturin'.
It doesn't hurt. Haster Larvisa," she added quickly. The little suspect gave the decor of the inquisitorial headquarters a disparaging look. There was a decided odor of onions.
"Huh?"
she said.
"I want to be a witch, with a warty nose and a green skin, and a lovely cat, and I'd call it Blackie, and lots of potions, and..."
The head torturer nodded to the chief inquisitor.
"Look," said Pepper desperately, "no one's saying you can't be a witch. You just have to say you're not a witch. No point in us taking all this trouble," she added severely, "if you're going to go round saying yes the minute we ask you."
The suspect considered this.
"But I wants to be a witch," she wailed.
The male them exchanged exhausted glances. This was out of their league.
"If you just say no," said Pepper, "you can have my Cindy stable set. I've never ever used it," she added, glaring at the other them and daring them to make a comment.
"You have used it," snapped her sister. "I've seen it, and it's all worn out, and the bit where you put the hay is broke, and..."
Adam gave a magisterial cough.
"Art thou a witch, Viva España?" he repeated.
The sister took a look at Pepper's face and decided not to chance it.
"No,"
she decided. It was a very good torture, everyone agreed. The trouble was getting the putative witch off it. It was a hot afternoon, and the inquisitorial guards felt that they were being put upon.
"Don't see why me and Brother Brian should have to do all the work," said Brother Wensleydale,
wiping the sweat off his brow.
"I reckon it's about time she got off and we had a go. Benedictine in a decanter."
"Why have we stopped?"
demanded the suspect, water pouring out of her shoes. It had occurred to the chief inquisitor during his researches that the British Inquisition was probably not yet ready for the reintroduction of the Iron Maiden and the Choke Pair. But an illustration of a medieval ducking stool suggested that it was tailor-made for the purpose. All you needed was a pond and some planks and a rope. It was the sort of combination that always attracted the them, who never had much difficulty in finding all three. The suspect was now green to the waist.
"It's just like a seesaw," she said. "Whee!"
"I'm going to go home unless I can have a go," muttered Brother Brian. "Don't see why evil witches should have all the fun."
"It's not allowed for inquisitors to be tortured, too," said the chief inquisitor sternly, but without much real feeling. It was a hot afternoon. The inquisitorial robes of old sacking were scratchy and smelled of stale barley, and the pond looked astonishingly inviting. All right, he said, and turned to the suspect. You're a witch, all right. Don't do it again. And now you get off and let someone else have a turn. Olé, he added.
What happens now? Said Pepper's sister.
Adam hesitated. Setting fire to her would probably cause no end of trouble, he reasoned. Besides, she was too soggy to burn. He was also distantly aware that at some future point there would be questions asked about muddy shoes and duckweed-encrusted pink dresses. But that was the future, and it lay at the other end of a long, warm afternoon that contained planks and ropes and ponds. The future could wait. The future came and went in the mildly discouraging way that futures do, although Mr. Young had other things on his mind apart from muddy dresses, and merely banned Adam from watching television, which meant he had to watch it on the old black-and-white set in his bedroom.
"I don't see why we should have a hosepipe ban," Adam heard Mr. Young telling Mrs. Young. "I pay my rates like everyone else. The garden looks like the Sahara Desert. I'm surprised there was any water left in the pond. I blame it on the lack of nuclear testing myself. You used to get proper summers when I was a boy. It used to rain all the time."
Now Adam slouched alone along the dusty lane. It was a good slouch. Adam had a way of slouching along that offended all right-thinking people. It wasn't that he just allowed his body to droop. He could slouch with inflections. And now the set of his shoulders reflected the hurt and bewilderment of those unjustly thwarted in their selfless desire to help their fellow men. Dust hung heavy on the bushes.
"Serve everyone right. The witches took over the whole country and made everyone eat health food and not go to church and dance around with no clothes on," he said, kicking a stone.
He had to admit that, except perhaps for the health food, the prospect wasn't too worrying.
"I bet if they'd just let us get started properly, we could have found hundreds of witches," he told himself, kicking a stone. "I bet old Torquemada didn't have to give up just when he was getting started, just because some stupid witch got her dress dirty."
Dog slouched alone dutifully behind his master. This wasn't, insofar as the hellhound had any expectations, what he had imagined life would be like in the last days before Armageddon. But, despite himself, he was beginning to enjoy it. He heard his master say,
"Bet even the Victorians didn't force people to have to watch black-and-white television."
Form shapes nature. There are certain ways of behavior appropriate to small, scruffy dogs, which are, in fact, welded into the genes. You can't just become small dog-shaped and hope to stay the same person. A certain intrinsic small dogness begins to permeate your very being. He'd already chased a rat. It had been the most enjoyable experience of his life.
"Serve 'em right if we're all overcome by evil forces," his master grumbled.
And then there were cats, thought Dog. He'd surprised the huge ginger cat from next door and had attempted to reduce it to cowering jelly by means of the usual glowing stare and deep-throated growl, which had always worked on the damned in the past. This time they earned him a whack on the nose that had made his eyes water. Cats, Dog considered, were clearly a lot tougher than lost souls. He was looking forward to a further cat experiment, which he'd planned would consist of jumping around and yapping excitedly at it. It was a long shot, but it might just work.
"They'd just better not come running to me when old Picky is turned into a frog, that's all," muttered Adam.
It was at this point that two facts dawned on him. One was that his disconsolate footsteps had led him past Jasmine Cottage. The other was that someone was crying. Adam was a soft touch for tears. He hesitated a moment, and then cautiously peered over the hedge. To Anathema, sitting in a deck chair and halfway through a packet of Kleenex, it looked like the rise of a small, disheveled sun. Adam doubted that she was a witch. Adam had a very clear mental picture of a witch. The Youngs restricted themselves to the only possible choice amongst the better class of Sunday newspaper, and so 100 years of enlightened occultism had passed Adam by. She didn't have a hooked nose or warts, and she was young. Well, quite young. That was good enough for him. "Hello," he said, unslouching. She blew her nose and stared at him. What was looking over the hedge should be described at this point. What Anathema saw was, she said later, something like a prepubescent Greek god, or maybe a biblical illustration, one which showed muscular angels doing some righteous smiting. It was a face that didn't belong in the 20th century. It was thatched with golden curls which glowed. Michelangelo should have sculpted it. He probably would not have included the battered sneakers, frayed jeans, or grubby T-shirt, though. "Who are you?" she said. "I'm Adam Young," said Adam. "I live just down the lane." "Oh, yes, I've heard of you," said Anathema, dabbing at her eyes. Adam preened. "Mrs. Henderson said I was to be sure to keep an eye out for you," she went on. "I'm well known around here," said Adam. "She said you were born to hang," said Anathema. Adam grinned. Notoriety wasn't as good as fame, but was heaps better than obscurity. "She said you were the worst of the lot of them," said Anathema, looking a little more cheerful. Adam nodded. "She said, you watch out for them, miss. They're nothing but a pack of ringleaders. That young Adam's full of the old Adam," she said. "What have you been crying for?" said Adam bluntly. Oh, I've just lost something," said Anathema. "A book." "I'll help you look for it if you like," said Adam gallantly. "I know quite a lot about books, actually. I wrote a book once. It was a terrific book. It was nearly 8 pages long. It was about this pirate who was a famous detective. And I drew the pictures." And then, in a flash of largesse, he added, "If you like, I'll let you read it. I bet it was a lot more exciting than any book you've lost. Especially the bit in the spaceship where the dinosaur comes out and fights for the cowboys. I bet it'd cheer you up, my book. It cheered up Brian no end. He said he'd never been so cheered up." "Thank you. I'm sure your book is a very good book," she said, endearing herself to Adam forever. "But I don't need you to help look for my book. I think it's too late now." She looked thoughtfully at Adam. "I expect you know this area very well," she said. "For miles and miles," said Adam. "You haven't seen two men in a big black car," said Anathema. "Did they steal it?" said Adam, suddenly full of interest. Foiling a gang of international book thieves would make a rewarding end of the day. "Not really. Sort of. I mean, they didn't mean to. They were looking for the manor. But I went up there today, and no one knows anything about them. There was some sort of accident or something, I believe." She stared at Adam. There was something odd about him, but she couldn't put her finger on it. She just had an urgent feeling that he was important and shouldn't be allowed to drift away. Something about him. "What's the book called?" said Adam. "The Nice and Accurate Prophecies of Agnes Nutter, Witch," said Anathema.
"Witch what?"
"No,
Which, like in Macbeth, said Anathema.
I saw that, said Adam.
It was really interesting the way them kings carried on. Gosh!
What's nice about them?
Nice used to mean, well, precise. Or exact.
Definitely something strange. A sort of laid-back intensity. You started to feel that if he was around, then everyone else, even the landscape, was just background. She'd been here a month. Except for Mrs. Henderson, who in theory looked after the cottage, and probably went through her things given half a chance, she hadn't exchanged more than a dozen real words with anyone. She'd let them think she was an artist. This was the kind of countryside that artists liked. Actually, it was bloody beautiful. Just around this village, it was superb. If Turner and Landseer had met Samuel Palmer in a pub and worked it all out, and then got Stubbs to do the horses, it couldn't have been better. And that was depressing, because this was where it was going to happen, according to Agnes anyway, in a book which she, Anathema, had allowed to be lost. She had the file cards, of course, but they just weren't the same. If Anathema had been in full control of her own mind at that moment, and no one around Adam was ever in full control of his or her own mind, she'd have noticed that whenever she tried to think about him beyond a superficial level, her thoughts slipped away like a duck off water.
Wicked, said Adam, who had been turning over in his mind the implications of a book of nice and accurate prophecies. It tells you who's going to win the Grand National, does it?
No, said Anathema.
Any spaceships in it?
Not many, said Anathema.
Robots?
Said Adam hopefully.
Sorry.
Doesn't sound very nice to me, then, said Adam. Don't see what the future's got in it if there's no robots and spaceships.
About 3 days, thought Anathema glumly. That's what it's got in it.
Would you like a lemonade?
She said. Adam hesitated. Then he decided to take the bull by the horns.
Look, excuse me for asking, if it's not a personal question, but are you a witch?
He said. Anathema narrowed her eyes. So much for Mrs. Henderson poking around.
Some people might say so, she said. Actually, I'm an occultist. Oh, well, that's all right, then, said Adam, cheering up.
She looked him up and down.
You know what an occultist is, do you?
She said.
Oh, yes, said Adam confidently.
Well, so long as you're happier now, said Anathema. Come on in. I could do with a drink myself. And
Adam Young?
Yes?
You were thinking... Nothing wrong with my eyes. They don't need examining.
Weren't you?
Who, me?
Said Adam guiltily.
Dog was the problem. He wouldn't go in the cottage. He crouched on the doorstep, growling.
Come on, you silly dog, said Adam. It's only old Jasmine Cottage.
He gave Anathema an embarrassed look.
Normally, he does everything I say right off.
You can leave him in the garden, said Anathema.
No, said Adam. He's got to do what he's told. I read it in a book. Training is very important. Any dog can be trained, it said. My father said I can only keep him if he's properly trained. Now, dog, go inside.
Dog whined and gave him a pleading look. His stubby tail thumped on the floor once or twice. His master's voice, with extreme reluctance, as if making progress in the teeth of a gale, he slunk over the doorstep.
There, said Adam proudly. Good boy.
And a little bit more of hell burned away. Anathema shut the door. There had always been a horseshoe over the door of Jasmine Cottage, ever since its first tenant centuries before. The Black Death was all the rage at the time, and he'd considered that he could use all the protection he could get. It was corroded and half-covered with a paint of centuries. So neither Adam nor Anathema gave it a thought or noticed how it was now cooling from a white heat. Azrafael's cocoa was stone cold. The only sound in the room was the occasional turning of a page. Every now and again there was a rattling at the door when prospective customers of intimate books next door mistook the entrance. He ignored it. Occasionally he would very nearly swear. Anathema hadn't really made herself at home in the cottage. Most of her implements were piled up on the table. It looked interesting. It looked, in fact, as though a voodoo priest had just had the run of a scientific equipment store.
"Brilliant," said Adam, prodding at it. "What's the thing with the three legs?"
"It's a theodolite," said Anathema from the kitchen. "It's for tracking ley lines."
"What are they, then?"
said Adam. She told him.
"Core," he said. "Are they?"
"Yes."
"All over the place?"
"Yes."
"I've never seen 'em. Amazing. There being all these invisible lines of force around and me not seeing them."
Adam didn't often listen, but he spent the most enthralling 20 minutes of his life, or at least of his life that day. No one in the Young household so much as touched wood or threw salt over their shoulder. The only nod in the direction of the supernatural was a half-hearted pretense when Adam had been younger that Father Christmas came down the chimney. Note: if Adam had been in full possession of his powers in those days, the Young's Christmas would have been spoiled by the discovery of a dead fat man upside down in their central heating duct. End note. He'd been starved of anything more occult than a harvest festival. Her words poured into his mind like water into a quire of blotting paper. Dog lay under the table and growled. He was beginning to have serious doubts about himself. Anathema didn't only believe in ley lines, but in seals, whales, bicycles, rainforests, whole grain in loaves, recycled paper, white South Africans out of South Africa, and Americans out of practically everywhere down to and including Long Island. She didn't compartmentalize her beliefs. They were welded into one enormous, seamless belief, compared with which that held by Joan of Arc seemed a mere idle notion. On any scale of mountain moving, it shifted at least 0.5 of an alp. Note: it may be worth noting here that most human beings can rarely raise more than 0.3 of an alp, 30 centi-alps. Adam believed things on a scale ranging from 2 through to 15,640 Everests. End note. No one had even used the word environment in Adam's hearing before. The South American rainforests were a closed book to Adam, and it wasn't even made of recycled paper. The only time he interrupted her was to agree with her views on nuclear power.
"I've been to a nuclear power station. It was boring. There was no green smoke and bubbling stuff in tubes. Shouldn't be allowed. Not having proper bubbling stuff when people have come all the way to see it. And having just a lot of men standing around, not even wearing spacesuits."
"They do all the bubbling after visitors have gone home," said Anathema grimly.
"Huh?"
said Adam.
"They should be done away with this minute." "Serve them right for not bubbling," said Adam.
Anathema nodded. She was still trying to put her finger on what was so odd about Adam, and then she realized what it was. He had no aura. She was quite an expert on auras. She could see them if she stared hard enough. They were a little glow of light around people's heads,
and according to a book she'd read, the color told you things about their health and general well-being. Everyone had one. In mean-minded, closed-in people, they were a faint, trembling outline, whereas expansive and creative people might have one extending several inches from the body. She'd never heard of anyone without one, but she couldn't see one around Adam at all. Yet he seemed cheerful, enthusiastic, and as well balanced as a gyroscope. Maybe I'm just tired, she thought. Anyway, she was pleased and gratified to find such a rewarding student, and even loaned him some copies of New Aquarian Digest, a small magazine edited by a friend of hers. It changed his life. At least it changed his life for that day. To his parents' astonishment, he went to bed early, and then lay under the blankets until after midnight with a torch, the magazines, and a bag of lemon drops. The occasional "brilliant" emerged from his ferocious chewing mouth. When the batteries ran out, he emerged into the darkened room and lay back with his head pillowed in his hands, apparently watching the squadron of X-Wing, trademark, fighters that hung from the ceiling. They moved gently in the night breeze. But Adam wasn't really watching them. He was staring instead into the brightly lit panorama of his own imagination, which was whirling like a fairground. This wasn't Wensleydale's aunt in a wine glass. This sort of occulting was a lot more interesting. Besides, he liked Anathema. Of course, she was very old, but when Adam liked someone, he wanted to make them happy. He wondered how he could make Anathema happy. It used to be thought that the events that changed the world were things like big bombs, maniac politicians, huge earthquakes, or vast population movements. But it has now been realized that this is a very old-fashioned view held by people totally out of touch with modern thought. The things that really change the world, according to chaos theory, are the tiny things. A butterfly flaps its wings in the Amazonian jungle, and subsequently, a storm ravages half of Europe. Somewhere in Adam's sleeping head, a butterfly had emerged. It might or might not have helped Anathema get a clear view of things, if she'd been allowed to spot the very obvious reason why she couldn't see Adam's aura. It was for the same reason that people in Trafalgar Square can't see England. Alarms went off. Of course, there's nothing special about alarms going off in the control room of a nuclear power station. They do it all the time. It's because there are many dials and meters and things that something important might not get noticed if it doesn't at least beep. And the job of shift charge engineer calls for a solid, capable, unflappable kind of man. The kind you can depend upon not to make a beeline for the car park in an emergency. The kind of man, in fact, who gives the impression of smoking a pipe, even when he's not. It was 3 a.m. in the control room of Turning Point Power Station. Normally a nice quiet time, when there is nothing much to do but fill in the log and listen to the distant roar of the turbines. Until now. Horace Gander looked at the flashing red lights. Then he looked at some dials. Then he looked at the faces of his fellow workers. Then he raised his eyes to the big dial at the far end of the room. 420 practically dependable and very nearly cheap megawatts were leaving the station. According to the other dials, nothing was producing them. He didn't say, "That's weird." He wouldn't have said "that's weird" if a flock of sheep had cycled past playing violins. It wasn't the sort of thing a responsible engineer said. What he did say was, "Alf, you'd better ring the station manager." 3 very crowded hours went past. They involved quite a lot of phone calls, telexes, and faxes.
27 people were got out of bed in quick succession, and they got another 53 out of bed, because if there is one thing a man wants to know when he's woken up in a panic at 4 a.m., it's that he's not alone. Anyway, you need all sorts of permissions before they let you unscrew the lid of a nuclear reactor and look inside. They got them. They unscrewed it. They had a look inside. Horace Gander said, "There's got to be a sensible reason for this. 500 tons of uranium don't just get up and walk away." A meter in his hand should have been screaming. Instead, it let out the occasional half-hearted tick. Where the reactor should have been was an empty space. You could have had quite a nice game of squash in it. Right at the bottom, all alone in the center of the bright, cold floor, was a lemon drop. Outside in the cavernous turbine hall, the machines roared on. And 100 miles away, Adam Young turned over in his sleep. Friday. Raven Sable, slim and bearded and dressed all in black, sat in the back of his slim-line black limousine, talking on his slim-line black telephone to his West Coast base. "How's it going?" he asked. "Looking good, Chief," said his marketing head. "I'm doing breakfast with the buyers from all the leading supermarket chains tomorrow. No problem. We'll have meals, trademark, in all the stores this time next month." "Good work, Nick." "No problem, no problem. It's knowing you're behind us, Rave. You give great leadership, guy. Works for me every time." "Thank you," said Sable, and he broke the connection. He was particularly proud of meals, trademark. The Nutrition Corporation had started small 11 years ago. A small team of food scientists, a huge team of marketing and public relations personnel, and a neat logo. 2 years of nutrition investment and research had produced Chow, trademark. Chow, trademark, contained spun, plated, and woven protein molecules, capped and coated, carefully designed to be ignored by even the most ravenous digestive tract enzymes. No cow sweeteners. Mineral oils replacing vegetable oils. Fibrous materials, colorings, and flavorings. The end result was a foodstuff almost indistinguishable from any other, except for two things. Firstly, the price, which was slightly higher. And secondly, the nutritional content, which was roughly equivalent to that of a Sony Walkman. It didn't matter how much you ate, you lost weight. Note. And hair, and skin tone, and if you ate enough of it, long enough, vital signs. End note. Fat people had bought it. Thin people who didn't want to get fat had bought it. Chow, trademark, was the ultimate diet food. Carefully spun, woven, textured, and pounded to imitate anything, from potatoes to venison, although the chicken sold best. Sable sat back and watched the money roll in. He watched Chow, trademark, gradually fill the ecological niche that used to be filled by the old untrademarked food. He followed Chow, trademark, with Snacks, trademark, junk food made from real junk. Meals, trademark, was Sable's latest brainwave. Meals, trademark, was Chow, trademark, with added sugar and fat. The theory was that if you ate enough meals, trademark, you would A, get very fat, and B, die of malnutrition. The paradox delighted Sable. Meals, trademark, were currently being tested all over America. Pizza meals, fish meals, Szechuan meals, macrobiotic rice meals, even hamburger meals. Sable's limousine was parked in the lot of a Des Moines, Iowa burger lord, a fast food franchise wholly owned by his organization. It was here they'd been piloting hamburger meals for the last 6 months. He wanted to see what kind of results they'd been getting. He leaned forward, tapped the chauffeur's glass partition. The chauffeur pressed the switch, and the glass slid open.
"Sir?"
"I'm going to take a look at our operation, Marlin. I'll be 10 minutes. Then back to L.A.
"Sir?"
Sable sauntered into the Burger Lord. It was exactly like every other Burger Lord in America. Note. But not like every other Burger Lord across the world. German Burger Lords, for example, sold lager instead of root beer, while English Burger Lords managed to take any American fast food virtues, the speed with which your food was delivered, for example, and carefully remove them. Your food arrived after half an hour at room temperature, and it was only because of the strip of warm lettuce between them that you could distinguish the burger from the bun. The Burger Lord Pathfinder salesman had been shot 25 minutes after setting foot in France. End note. McLordy the clown danced in the kitty corner. The serving staff had identical, gleaming smiles that never reached their eyes. And behind the counter, a chubby, middle-aged man in a Burger Lord uniform slapped burgers onto the griddle, whistling softly, happy in his work. Sable went up to the counter.
"Hello, my name is Marie," said the girl behind the counter. "How can I help you?"
"A double blaster thunder biggin, extra fries, hold the mustard," he said.
"Anything to drink?"
"A special thick whippy choco banana shake." She pressed the little pictogram squares on her till. Literacy was no longer a requirement for employment in these restaurants. Smiling was. Then she turned to the chubby man behind the counter.
"DBTBEF, hold mustard," she said. "Chalk shake."
Crooned the cook. He sorted the food into little paper containers, pausing only to brush the graying cowlick from his eyes.
"Here you are," he said.
She took them without looking at him, and he returned cheerfully to his griddle, singing quietly,
"Love me tender, love me long, never let me go."
The man's humming, Sable noted, clashed with the Burger Lord background music, a tinny tape loop of the Burger Lord commercial jingle, and he made a mental note to have him fired. "Hello, my name is Marie," gave Sable his meal trademark, and told him to have a nice day. He found a small plastic table, sat down in the plastic seat, and examined his food. Artificial bread roll, artificial burger, fries that had never even seen potatoes, foodless sauces, even, and Sable was especially pleased with this, an artificial slice of dill pickle. He didn't bother to examine his milkshake. It had no actual food content, but then again, neither did those sold by any of his rivals. All around him, people were eating their unfood with, if not actual evidence of enjoyment, then with no more actual disgust than was to be found in burger chains all over the planet. He stood up, took his tray over to the "Please dispose of your refuse with care" receptacle, and dumped the whole thing. If you had told him that there were children starving in Africa, he would have been flattered that you had noticed. There was a tug at his sleeve.
"Party name is Sable?"
asked a small, bespectacled man in an International Express cap, holding a brown paper parcel. Sable nodded.
"Thought it was you. Looked around, thought. Tall gent with a beard. Nice suit. Can't be that many of them here. Package for you, sir?"
Sable signed for it. His real name. One word. 6 letters. Sounds like examine.
"Thank you kindly, sir," said the delivery man.
He paused.
"Here," he said. "That bloke behind the counter, does he remind you of anyone?"
"No," said Sable. He gave the man a tip, $5, and opened the package. In it was a small pair of brass scales. Sable smiled. It was a slim smile, and was gone almost instantly. "About time," he said. He thrust the scales into his pocket, unheeding of the damage being done to the sleek line of his black suit, and went back to the limo.
"Back to the office?"
asked the chauffeur. "The airport," said Sable, "and call ahead. I want a ticket to England."
"Yes, sir.
Return ticket to England." Sable fingered the scales in his pocket. "Make that a single," he said. "I'll be making my own way back. Oh, and call the office for me. Cancel all appointments."
"How long for, sir?"
"The foreseeable future." And in the Burger Lord, behind the counter, the stout man with the cowlick slid another half-dozen burgers onto the grill. He was the happiest man in the whole world, and he was singing very softly. "You ain't never caught a rabbit," he hummed to himself, "and you ain't no friend of mine." The Vim listened with interest. There was a light drizzle which was barely kept at bay by the old iron sheets and frayed bits of lino that roofed their den in the quarry, and they always looked to Adam to think up things to do when it was raining. They weren't disappointed. Adam's eyes were agleam with the joy of knowledge. It had been 3 a.m. before he'd gone to sleep under a pile of new aquarians.
"And then there was this man called Charles Fort," he said. "He could make it rain fish and frogs and stuff."
"Huh?"
said Pepper.
"I bet. Alive frogs?"
"Oh, yes," said Adam, warming to his subject.
"Hopping around and croaking and everything. People paid him money to go away in the end, and...
He racked his brains for something that would satisfy his audience. He'd done, for Adam, a lot of reading in one go.
"And he sailed off in the Mary Celeste and founded the Bermuda Triangle. It's in Bermuda,"
he added helpfully.
"No, he couldn't have done that," said Wensleydale sternly, "because I've read about the Mary Celeste, and there was no one on it. It's famous for having no one on it. They found it floating around all by itself with no one on it." "I didn't say he was on it when they found it, did I?" said Adam scathingly. "Course he wasn't on it. 'Cause of the UFOs landing and taking him off. I thought everyone knew about that."
The Them relaxed a bit. They were on firmer ground with UFOs. They weren't entirely certain about New Age UFOs, though. They'd listened politely to Adam on the subject, but somehow modern UFOs lacked punch.
"If I was an alien," said Pepper, voicing the opinion of them all, "I wouldn't go round telling people all about mystic cosmic harmony. I'd say..."
Her voice became hoarse and nasal, like someone hampered by an evil black mask.
"This is a laser blaster, so you do what you're told, rebel swine."
They all nodded. A favorite game in Quarry had been based on a highly successful film series with lasers, robots, and a princess who wore her hair like a pair of stereo headphones. Trademark. It had been agreed, without a word being said, that if anyone was going to play the part of any stupid princesses, it wasn't going to be Pepper. But the game normally ended in a fight to be the one who was allowed to wear the coal scuttle, trademark, and blow up planets. Adam was best at it. When he was the villain, he really sounded as if he could blow up the world. The Them were, anyway, temperamentally on the side of planet destroyers, provided they could be allowed to rescue princesses at the same time.
"I expect that's what they used to do," said Adam, "but now it's different. They all have this bright blue light around them and go around doing good. Sort of galactic policemen, going round telling everyone to live in universal harmony and stuff."
There was a moment's silence while they pondered this waste of perfectly good UFOs.
"What I've always wondered," said Brian, "is why they call them UFOs, when they know they're flying saucers. I mean, they're identified flying objects then."
"It's 'cause the government hushes it all up," said Adam. "Millions of flying saucers landing all the time, and the government keeps hushing it up."
"Why?"
said Wensleydale. Adam hesitated. His reading hadn't provided a quick explanation for this. New Aquarian just took it as the foundation of belief, both of itself and its readers, that the government hushed everything up.
"'Cause they're the government," said Adam simply. "That's what governments do. They've got this great big building in London full of books of all the things they've hushed up. When the Prime Minister gets into work in the morning, the first thing he does is go through the big list of everything that's happened in the night and put this big red stamp on them. I bet he has a cup of tea first and then reads the paper," said Wensleydale, who had on one memorable occasion during the holidays gone unexpectedly into his father's office, where he had formed certain impressions, "and talks about what was on TV last night. Well, all right. But after that, he gets out the book and the big stamp." "Which says, 'Hush it up,'" said Pepper.
"It says, 'Top Secret,'" said Adam, resenting this attempt at bipartisan creativity. "It's like nuclear power stations. They keep blowing up all the time, but no one ever finds out, 'cause the government hushes it up."
"They don't keep blowing all the time," said Wensleydale severely. "My father says they're dead safe, and mean we don't have to live in a greenhouse. Anyway, there's a big picture of one in my comic."
Note: Wensleydale's alleged comic was a 94-week part work called Wonders of Nature and Science. He had every single one so far, and had asked for a set of binders for his birthday. Brian's weekly reading was anything with a lot of exclamation marks in the title, like "whiz" or "clang." So was Pepper's, although even under the most refined of tortures, she still wouldn't admit to the fact that she also bought just 17 under plain covers. Adam didn't read any comics at all. They never lived up to the kind of things he could do in his head. End note.
"And it doesn't say anything about it blowing up."
"Yes," said Brian, "but you lent me that comic afterwards, and I know what type of picture it was." Wensleydale hesitated, and then said in a voice heavy with badly tried patience,
"Brian, just because it says exploded diagram..."
There was the usual brief scuffle.
"Look," said Adam severely, "do you want me to tell you about the Aquarium Age or not?"
The fight, never very serious amongst the siblinghood of the them, subsided.
"Right," said Adam. He scratched his head. "Now you've made me forget where I've got to," he complained.
"Flying saucers," said Brian.
"Right, right. Well, if you do see a flying UFO, these government men come and tell you off," said Adam, getting back into his stride. "In a big black car. It happens all the time in America."
The them nodded sagely. Of this, at least, they had no doubt. America was, to them, the place that good people went to when they died. They were prepared to believe that just about anything could happen in America.
"Probably causes traffic jams," said Adam. "All these men in black cars, going about telling people off for seeing UFOs. They tell you that if you go on seeing them, you'll have a nasty accident."
"Probably get run over by a big black car," said Brian, picking at a scab on a dirty knee. He brightened up.
"Do you know," he said, "my cousin said that in America There's shops that sell 39 different flavors of ice cream.
This even silenced Adam briefly.
There aren't 39 flavors of ice cream, said Pepper. There aren't 39 flavors in the whole world.
There could be if you mix them up, said Wensleydale, blinking owlishly.
You know, strawberry and chocolate, chocolate and vanilla.
He sought for more English flavors.
Strawberry and vanilla and chocolate, he added lamely. And then there's Atlantis, said Adam loudly.
He had their interest there. They enjoyed Atlantis. Cities that sank under the sea were right up to them street. They listened intently to a jumbled account of pyramids, weird priesthoods, and ancient secrets.
Did it just happen sudden or slowly? Said Brian.
Sort of sudden and slowly, said Adam.
'Cause a lot of 'em got away in boats to all the other countries and taught 'em how to do maths and English and history and stuff.
Don't see what's so great about that, said Pepper.
Could have been good fun when it was sinking, said Brian wistfully,
recalled the one occasion when Lower Tadfield had been flooded.
People delivering the milk and newspapers by boat, no one having to go to school.
If I was an Atlantisan, I'd have stayed, said Wensleydale.
This was greeted with disdainful laughter, but he pressed on.
You just have to wear a diver's helmet, that's all, and nail all the windows shut and fill the houses with air. It would be great.
Adam greeted this with the chilly stare he reserved for any of them who came up with an idea he really wished he'd thought of first.
They could have done, he conceded, somewhat weakly. After they'd sent all the teachers off in the boats. Maybe everyone else stayed on when it went down.
You wouldn't have to wash, said Brian,
whose parents forced him to wash a great deal more than he thought could possibly be healthy. Not that it did any good. There was something basically ground in about Brian.
Because everything would stay clean, and you could grow seaweed and stuff in the garden and shoot sharks, and have pet octopuses and stuff. And there wouldn't be any schools and stuff because they'd have got rid of all the teachers.
They could still be down there now, said Pepper.
They thought about the Atlanteans, clad in flowing mystic robes and goldfish bowls, enjoying themselves deep under the choppy waters of the ocean.
Huh?
Said Pepper, summing up their feelings.
What shall we do now? Said Brian. It's brightened up a bit.
In the end, they played Charles Fort Discovering Things. This consisted of one of them walking around with the ancient remains of an umbrella, while the others treated him to a rain of frogs. Or rather, frog. They could only find one in the pond. It was an elderly frog, who knew the them of old, and tolerated their interest as the price it paid for a pond otherwise free of moorhens and pike. It put up with things good-naturedly for a while before hopping off to a secret and so far undiscovered hideout in an old drainpipe. Then they went home for lunch. Adam felt very pleased about the morning's work. He'd always known that the world was an interesting place, and his imagination had peopled it with pirates and bandits and spies and astronauts and similar. But he'd also had a nagging suspicion that, when you seriously got right down to it, they were all just things in books and didn't properly exist anymore. Whereas this Aquarian Age stuff was really real. Grown-up people wrote lots of books about it. New Aquarian was full of adverts for them. And Bigfoots, and Mothmen, and Yetis, and Sea Monsters, and Surrey Pumas really existed. If Cortez, on his peak in Darien, had had slightly damp feet from efforts at catching frogs, he'd have felt just like Adam at that moment. The world was bright and strange, and he was in the middle of it. He bolted his lunch and retired to his room. There were still quite a few new Aquarians he hadn't read yet. The cocoa was a congealed brown sludge half-filling the cup. Certain people had spent hundreds of years trying to make sense of the prophecies of Agnes Nutter. They had been very intelligent in the main. Anathema Device, who was about as close to being Agnes as genetic drift would allow, was the best of the bunch. But none of them had been angels. Many people, meeting Aziraphale for the first time, formed three impressions. That he was English, that he was intelligent, and that he was gayer than a tree full of monkeys on nitrous oxide. Two of these were wrong. Heaven is not in England, whatever certain poets may have thought, and angels are sexless, unless they really want to make an effort. But he was intelligent. And it was an angelic intelligence, which, while not being particularly higher than human intelligence, is much broader, and has the advantage of having thousands of years of practice. Aziraphale was the first angel ever to own a computer. It was a cheap, slow, plasticky one, much touted as ideal for the small businessman. Aziraphale used it religiously for doing his accounts, which were so scrupulously accurate that the tax authorities had inspected him 5 times in the deep belief that he was getting away with murder somewhere. But these other calculations were of a kind no computer could ever do. Sometimes he would scribble something on a sheet of paper by his side. It was covered in symbols which only 8 other people in the world would have been able to comprehend. 2 of them had won Nobel Prizes, and 1 of the other 6 dribbled a lot and wasn't allowed anything sharp because of what he might do with it. Anathema lunched on miso soup and pored over her maps. There was no doubt the area around Tadfield was rich in ley lines. Even the famous Reverend Watkins had identified some. But unless she was totally wrong, they were beginning to shift position. She'd spent the week taking soundings with theodolite and pendulum, and the ordnance survey map of the Tadfield area was now covered with little dots and arrows. She stared at them for some time. Then she picked up a felt-tip pen, and with occasional references to her notebook, began to join them up. The radio was on. She wasn't really listening, so quite a lot of the main news item passed right by her unheeding ears. And it wasn't until a couple of key words filtered down into her consciousness that she began to take notice. Someone called a spokesman sounded close to hysteria. "Danger to employees or the public," he was saying. "And precisely how much nuclear material has escaped," said the interviewer. There was a pause. "We wouldn't say escaped," said the spokesman. "Not escaped. Temporarily mislaid." "You mean it is still on the premises?" "We certainly cannot see how it could have been removed from them," said the spokesman. "Surely you have considered terrorist activity?" There was another pause. Then the spokesman said, in the quiet tones of someone who has had enough and is going to quit after this and raise chickens somewhere, "Yes, I suppose we must. All we need to do is find some terrorists who are capable of taking an entire nuclear reactor out of its can while it's running and without anyone noticing. It weighs about 1,000 tons and is 40 feet high. So they'll be quite strong terrorists. Perhaps you'd like to ring them up, sir, and ask them questions in that supercilious accusatory way of yours." "But you said the power station is still producing electricity," gasped the interviewer. "It is. How can it still be doing that if it hasn't got any reactors?" You could see the spokesman's mad grin, even on the radio. You could see his pen poised over the Farms for Sale column in Poultry World. "We don't know," he said.
We were hoping you clever buggers at the BBC would have an idea.
Anathema looked down at her map. What she had been drawing looked like a galaxy, or the type of carving seen on the better class of Celtic monolith. The ley lines were shifting. They were forming a spiral. It was centered, loosely with some margin for error, but nevertheless centered, on Lower Tadfield. Several thousand miles away, at almost the same moment as Anathema was staring at her spirals, the pleasure cruiser Morbilli was aground in 300 fathoms of water. For Captain Vincent, this was just another problem. For example, he knew he should contact the owners, but he never knew from day to day, or from hour to hour in this computerized world, actually who the current owners were. Computers. That was the bloody trouble. The ship's papers were computerized, and it could switch to the most currently advantageous flag of convenience in microseconds. Its navigation had been computerized as well, constantly updating its position by satellites. Captain Vincent had explained patiently to the owners, whoever they were, that several hundred square meters of steel plating and a barrel of rivets would be a better investment, and had been informed that his recommendation did not accord with current cost-slash-benefit flow predictions. Captain Vincent strongly suspected that, despite all its electronics, the ship was worth more sunk than afloat, and would probably go down as the most perfectly pinpointed wreck in nautical history. By inference, this also meant that he was more valuable dead than alive. He sat at his desk quietly leafing through International Maritime Codes, whose 600 pages contained brief yet pregnant messages designed to transmit the news of every conceivable nautical eventuality across the world, with the minimum of confusion, and above all, cost. What he wanted to say was this. While sailing south-southwest at position 33 degrees north, 47 degrees, 72 minutes west. First mate, who you may recall was appointed in New Guinea against my wishes, and is probably a headhunter, indicated by signs that something was amiss. It appears that quite a vast expanse of seabed has risen up in the night. It contains a large number of buildings, many of which appeared pyramid-like in structure. We are aground in the courtyard of one of these. There are some rather unpleasant statues. Amiable old men in long robes and diving helmets have come aboard the ship and are mingling happily with the passengers, who think we organize this. Please advise. His questing finger moved slowly down the page and stopped. Good old International Codes. They'd been devised 80 years before, but the men in those days had really thought hard about the kind of perils that might possibly be encountered on the deep. He picked up his pen and wrote down Roman numeral XXXVQVVX. Translated, it meant, have found lost continent of Atlantis. High priest has just won quoits contest.
It jolly well isn't. It jolly well is. It isn't, you know. It jolly well is. It isn't. All right, then, what about volcanoes?
Wensleydale sat back, a look of triumph on his face.
What about them? Said Adam. All that lather comes up from the center of the earth, where it's all hot, said Wensleydale. I saw a program. It had David Attenborough, so it's true.
The other them looked at Adam. It was like watching a tennis match. The hollow earth theory was not going over well in the quarry. A beguiling idea that had stood up to the probings of such remarkable thinkers as Cyrus Reed Teed, Bulwer Lytton, and Adolf Hitler was bending dangerously in the wind of Wensleydale's searingly bespectacled logic.
I didn't say it was hollow all the way through, said Adam. No one said it was hollow all the way through. It probably goes down miles and miles, to make room for all the lather and oil and coal and Tibetan tunnels and such like. But then, it's hollow after that. That's what people think. And there's a hole at the North Pole to let the air in.
Never seen it on an atlas, sniffed Wensleydale. The government won't let them put it on a map in case people go and have a look in, said Adam. The reason being, the people living inside don't want people looking down on them all the time.
What do you mean, Tibetan tunnels? Said Pepper. You said Tibetan tunnels.
Ah, didn't I tell you about them?
Three heads shook.
It's amazing. You know Tibet?
They nodded doubtfully. A series of images had risen in their minds. Yaks, Mount Everest, people called Grasshopper, little old men sitting on mountains, other people learning kung fu in ancient temples, and snow.
Well, you know all those teachers that left Atlantis when it sunk?
They nodded again.
Well, some of them went to Tibet, and now they run the world. They're called the Secret Masters, on account of being teachers, I suppose. And they've got this secret underground city called Shambhala, and tunnels that go all over the world, so they know everything that goes on and control everything. Some people reckon that they really live under the Gobi Desert, he added loftily. But most competent authorities reckon it's Tibet all right. Better for the tunneling anyway.
The them instinctively looked down at the grubby, dirt-covered chalk beneath their feet.
How come they know everything? Said Pepper.
They just have to listen, right? Hazarded Adam. They just have to sit in their tunnels and listen. You know what hearing teachers have? They can hear a whisper right across the room. My granny used to put a glass against the wall, said Brian. She said it was disgusting the way she could hear everything that went on next door.
And these tunnels go everywhere, do they?
Said Pepper, still staring at the ground.
All over the world, said Adam firmly. Must have took a long time, said Pepper doubtfully. You remember when we tried digging that tunnel out in the field? We were at it all afternoon, and you had to scrunch up to get all in. Yes, but they've been doing it for millions of years. You can do really good tunnels if you got millions of years. I thought the Tibetans were conquered by the Chinese and the Dalai Lama had to go to India, said Wensleydale, but without much conviction.
Wensleydale read his father's newspaper every evening, but the prosaic everydayness of the world always seemed to melt under the powerhouse of Adam's explanations.
I bet they're down there now, said Adam, ignoring this. They'd be all over the place by now, sitting underground and listening.
They looked at one another.
If we dug down quickly, said Brian.
Pepper, who was a lot quicker on the uptake, groaned.
What did you have to go and say that for, said Adam. Fat lot of good us trying to surprise them now, isn't it, with you shouting out something like that? I was just thinking we could dig down and... You just have to go and warn them.
I don't think they'd dig all those tunnels, said Wensleydale doggedly. It doesn't make any sense. Tibet's hundreds of miles away. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. And I suppose you know more about it than Madame Blatvatatatsky, sniffed Adam. Now, if I was a Tibetan, said Wensleydale, in a reasonable tone of voice, I'd just dig straight down to the hollow bit in the middle and then run around the inside and dig straight up where I wanted to be.
They gave this due consideration.
You've got to admit that's more sensible than tunnels, said Pepper. Yes, well, I expect that's what they do, said Adam. They'd be bound to have thought of something as simple as that.
Brian stared dreamily at the sky, while his finger probed the contents of one ear.
funny, really, he said. You spend your whole life going to school and learning stuff, and they never tell you about stuff like the Bermuda Triangle and UFOs and all these old masters running around the inside of the Earth. Why do we have to learn boring stuff when there's all this brilliant stuff we could be learning? That's what I want to know. There was a chorus of agreement. Then they went out and played Charles Fort and the Atlantisans versus the ancient masters of Tibet. But the Tibetans claimed that using mystic ancient lasers was cheating. There was a time when witch finders were respected, although it didn't last very long. Matthew Hopkins, for example, the witch finder general, found witches all over the east of England in the middle of the 17th century, charging each town and village 9 pence a witch for everyone he discovered. That was the trouble. Witch finders didn't get paid by the hour. Any witch finder who spent a week examining the local crones and then told the mayor, "Well done, not a pointy hat among the lot of them," would get fulsome thanks, a bowl of soup, and a meaningful goodbye. So in order to turn a profit, Hopkins had to find a remarkable number of witches. This made him more than a little unpopular with the village councils, and he himself was hanged as a witch by an East Anglian village who had sensibly realized that they could cut their overheads by eliminating the middleman. It is thought by many that Hopkins was the last witch-finder general. In this, they would, strictly speaking, be correct. Possibly not in the way they imagine, however. The witch-finder army marched on, just slightly more quietly. There is no longer a real witch-finder general. Nor is there a witch-finder colonel, a witch-finder major, a witch-finder captain, or even a witch-finder lieutenant. The last one was killed falling out of a very tall tree in Caterham in 1933 while attempting to get a better view of something he believed was a satanic orgy of the most degenerate persuasion, but was in fact the Caterham and White Leaf Market Traders Association annual dinner and dance. There is, however, a witchfinder sergeant. There is also now a witchfinder private. His name is Newton Pulsifer. It was the advertisement that got him, in the Gazette, between a fridge for sale and a litter of not exactly Dalmatians. Join the professionals, part-time. Assistant required to combat the forces of darkness. Uniform, basic training provided. Field promotion certain. Be a man. In his lunch hour, he phoned the number at the bottom of the ad. A woman answered.
"Hello," he began tentatively. "I saw your advert."
"Which one, love?"
"The one in the paper."
"Right, love. Well, Madam Tracy draws aside the veil every afternoon except Thursdays. Party's welcome. When would you be wanting to explore the mysteries, love?"
Newton hesitated.
"The advert says, join the professionals," he said. "It didn't mention Madam Tracy." "That'd be Mr. Shadwell you'd be wanting then. Just a sec, I'll see if he's in." Later, when he was on nodding terms with Madam Tracy, Newt learned that if he had mentioned the other ad, the one in the magazine, Madam Tracy would have been available for strict discipline and intimate massage every evening except Thursdays. There was yet another ad in a phone box somewhere. When, much later, Newt asked her what this one involved, she said, "Thursdays." Eventually, there was the sound of feet in uncarpeted hallways, a deep coughing, and a voice the color of an old raincoat rumbled,
I
read your advert. Join the professionals? I wanted to know a bit more about it.
There's many as would like to know more about it. And there's many...
The voice trailed off impressively, and then crashed back to full volume.
There's many as wouldn't.
Oh, squeaked Newton.
What's your name, lad?
Newton. Newton Pulsifer.
Lucifer? What's that you say? Are ye of the spawn of darkness, a tempting, beguiling creature from the pit, wanton limbs steaming from the flesh-pots of Hades, in tortured and lubricious thrall to your Stygian and hellish masters?
That's Pulsifer, explained Newton. With a P. I don't know about the other stuff, but we come from Surrey. The voice on the phone sounded vaguely disappointed.
Oh, aye. Well then, Pulsifer. Pulsifer. I've seen that name afore, maybe.
I don't know, said Newton. My uncle runs a toy shop in Hounslow, he added, in case this was any help.
Is that so? Said Shadwell.
Mr. Shadwell's accent was unplaceable. It careered around Britain like a milk race. Here a mad Welsh drill sergeant, there a High Kirk elder who'd just seen someone doing something on a Sunday. Somewhere between them, a dour Dalen shepherd or bitter Somerset miser. It didn't matter where the accent went, it didn't get any nicer.
Have ye all your own teeth?
Oh, yes, except for fillings.
Are ye fit?
I suppose so, Newt stuttered. I mean, that was why I wanted to join the Territorials. Brian Potter in accounting can bench press almost 100 since he joined, and he paraded in front of the Queen Mother.
How many nipples?
Pardon?
Nipples, laddie, nipples, said the voice testily. How many nipples have you got?
Two.
Good. Have you got your own scissors?
What?
Scissors, scissors! Are you deaf?
No, yes, I mean, I've got some scissors. I'm not deaf. The cocoa had nearly all solidified. Green fur was growing on the inside of the mug. There was a thin layer of dust on Azrafail, too. The stack of notes was building up beside him. The nice and accurate prophecies was a mass of improvised bookmarks made of torn strips of Daily Telegraph. Azrafail stirred and pinched his nose. He was nearly there. He'd got the shape of it. He'd never met Agnes. She was too bright, obviously. Normally, heaven or hell spotted the prophetic types and broadcast enough noises on the same mental channel to prevent any undue accuracy. Actually, that was rarely necessary. They normally found ways of generating their own static and self-defense against the images that echoed around their heads. Poor old St. John had his mushrooms, for example. Mother Shipton had her ale. Nostradamus had his collection of interesting Oriental preparations. St. Malachi had his still. Good old Malachi. He'd been a nice old boy, sitting there, dreaming about future popes. Complete piss artist, of course. Could have been a real thinker, if it hadn't been for the poteen. A sad end. Sometimes you really had to hope that the ineffable plan had been properly thought out. Thought. There was something he had to do. Oh, yes. Phone his contact. Get things sorted out. He stood up, stretched his limbs, and made a phone call. Then he thought, why not? Worth a try. He went back and shuffled through his sheaf of notes. Agnes really had been good. And clever. No one was interested in accurate prophecies. Paper in hand, he phoned directory inquiries. Hello. Good afternoon. So kind. Yes. This will be a Tadfield number, I think. Or lower Tadfield. Ah. Or possibly Norton. I'm not sure the precise code. Yes. Young. Name of Young. Sorry. No initial. Oh. Well, can you give me all of them? Thank you. Back on the table, the pencil picked itself up and scribbled furiously. At the third name, it broke its point. Ah, said Azrafail, his mouth suddenly running on automatic while his mind exploded. I think that's the one. Thank you. So kind. Good day to you. He hung up almost reverentially, took a few deep breaths, and dialed again. The last three digits gave him some trouble because his hand was shaking. He listened to the ringing tone. Then a voice answered. It was a middle-aged voice, not unfriendly, but probably it had been having a nap and was not feeling at its best. It said,
"Padfield, 666.
Azrafael's hand started to shake.
"Hello?"
said the receiver.
"Hello?"
Azrafael got a grip on himself. "Sorry," he said. "Right number." He replaced the receiver. Newt wasn't deaf, and he did have his own scissors. He also had a huge pile of newspapers. If he had known that army life consisted chiefly of applying the one to the other, he used to muse, he would never have joined. Witchfinder Sergeant Shadwell had made him a list, which was taped to the wall in Shadwell's tiny, crowded flat situated over Rajit's newsagents and video rental. The list read, 1. Witches. 2. Unexplainable phenomenons. Phenomenatrices. Phenomenies. Things ye can well what I mean. Newt was looking for either. He sighed and picked up another newspaper, scanned the front page, opened it, ignored page 2, never anything on there, then blushed crimson as he performed the obligatory nipple count on page 3. Shadwell had been insistent about this.
"Ye can't trust them, the cunning buggers," he said. "It'd be just like them to come right out in the open, like defying us."
A couple in black turtleneck sweaters glowered at the camera on page 9.